You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2023 on Monocle Radio.
The UK extends its experiment with obnoxiousness as a deterrent to migration. Could Vladimir Putin's next overseas trip end up being a stopover en route to The Hague? And Amsterdam pioneers the anti-tourism ad campaign. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Caroline Frost and Phil Clark will discuss all the day's big stories, and our On This Day historical series will consider how great eruptions like the Indian Mutiny of 1857 can be ignited by an unpromising or even accidental spark. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by the writer, journalist, and broadcaster Caroline Frost, and by Phil Clark, Professor of International Politics at SOAS University of London. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Good evening, Andrew.
Caroline, it has been a while, and it is excellent to see you back.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I've been under the chemo cloud, but I guess my reason for mentioning that is that I'm through the other side, still here to tell the tale, and just want to say to people, not always as bad as you think. So, so that's the message. Yes, one of very great relief and euphoria to be back out.
As a reward for that upbeat and encouraging introduction to the show, would you like another free plug for your book?
Oh, you're so sweet. That's my gift, is it? Yes, I'll come back out for that most certainly. Yes, it's still selling. Can you believe there was a rush on just before Christmas? And every time, for the uneducated, it's the definitive. I like to think history of the Carry On films. And every time there's any kind of anniversary, of which there are many because there are so many films and so many stars, that little book just pops up and keeps on giving out on the social media platforms and fan groups. So keep it coming, I say, and thank you very much.
And Phil, is your equally commercially scalable epic anywhere near a publication?
This always happens to me on the daily, that's someone with a book that people will read in their droves always gets paired with me, who'll have an audience of four, I think, for my absolute blockbuster on Rwanda's welfare system, which is due out just in time for Easter 2024. So please don't rush out too quickly to buy that.
So no need for people to start occupying a space outside the bookstore with their sleeping bag and camping stove yet?
I've seen them already. It's amazing how many fans of Mass Atrocity there are out there waiting for this.
We'll get the advent calendars printed in due course, but we will be starting tonight's show proper here in the UK, where the government continues to discover that controlling one's borders is much easier said than done, in much the same way that proposing draconian solutions likely to find favour with a core voter base of angry retired colonels is a good deal more straightforward than devising a means of dealing with boat-borne migrants, which is all at once effective and humane. The latest wheeze being proposed is to move migrants out of hotels, the expense of which is considerable and the optics of which are terrible, and relocate them to abandoned barracks on former military bases. Immigration Minister Robert Jenrick spoke about these plans in the House of Commons earlier.
This government remains committed to meeting our legal obligations to those who would otherwise be destitute. But we're not prepared to go further. Accommodation for migrants should meet their essential living needs and nothing more, because we cannot risk becoming a magnet for the millions of people who are displaced and seeking better economic prospects. Many of our European partners are struggling with the same issue. Belgium, Ireland, Germany, and France are having to take similar steps, and the UK must adapt to this changing context. I've said before that we have to suffuse our entire system with deterrence, and this must include how we house illegal migrants. So today the government is announcing the first tranche of sites we will set up to provide basic accommodation at scale.
Immigration Minister Robert Jenrick speaking earlier. Phil, that phrase to any Australian listeners or indeed Australian host or panellist sounds rather familiar. Suffuse our entire system with deterrence. Is the UK still trying to impose the Australia solution with not Australian geography?
Yes. And in fact, it's copied almost letter by letter from the Australian experience. The former Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer was called in to do a review of Border Force 3 years ago, and this is precisely the kind of behaviour that he recommended. So we are actually seeing a copy of the Australian model, basically to be as nasty as possible in the hope that this will somehow deter people from making this dangerous journey across the channel. Of course, it won't work. They've copied the Australian model, but they haven't learnt the Australian lesson, which is even if you treat people as inhumanely as the British government undoubtedly will, it won't stop the boats coming. It won't stop desperate people looking for asylum in a country like the UK.
But just to follow that up, Phil, in Australia, draconian though the measures were and different though the geography is, it obviously being much more of a thing requiring much larger ships to get from Indonesia to Australia than from France to the UK, the boats did pretty much stop.
Yes, but then what we saw was people coming by other means. So if you look at the overall number of asylum seekers and refugees in Australia, the numbers really haven't budged at all. And then, of course, what these measures also do is then put an enormous expense on the UK taxpayer to put people up in these very inhumane camps. It would be much cheaper, actually, to make the Home Office a functional bureaucratic entity to deal with these people in a humane way, give them visas that enable them to work in the general public. That is a humane response. It also makes good economic sense.
That is true, but it's also the case, is it not, Caroline, that scarcely discourages more people from coming, which is what the government want to do. The point they're trying to make at the moment about relocating them out of hotels is that there are currently 51,000 people in 395 hotels costing 6.2 million quid a day, to say nothing of strain on local services, and plus the optics of which are rickety as far as the government is concerned. But is there a solution short of what Robert Jenrick is proposing, which does have some deterrent effect and yet does treat those people who are here somewhat more humanely?
With some compassion. Fascinating. I mean, if it wasn't real lives we're talking about, this is a classic ethical dilemma. I feel very much at home with these Australian accents because I did my ethics degree in Melbourne, where we discussed things like the ethical right, and then, of course, the efficacy and the practical aspects of any problem like this. The question is, of course, everything we're seeing in these reports is about NIMBY, isn't it? It's for the uninformed of British politics and British society generally, that very much stands for not in my backyard. So you're seeing Conservative, so Tory MPs, bearing in mind this is meant to be on the same side of the fence as the government, saying, I like it in theory, as long as you don't come to my gaff, my manor, my constituents, I want to be re-elected at the next election. So what we're seeing is the government flailing. I mean, the opposition are calling it this just an abandonment, an admission of failure. I mean, they say they haven't mentioned boats yet, the ferries. The idea, though, I mean, I'm not sure where that ends. That puts them somewhere for now, but that's no meaningful existence, is it? Yes, it's safe, but it in no way gives somebody some self-determination, hope for the future, a foundation on which to build. And yet that this is seen to be the next sort of plan B, because this is clearly going to fail. There isn't going to be enough support for it, either as a compassionate way forward or as a practical solution. So I don't have an answer, but neither does the government, it seems.
Phil, the thing I wonder about, it's a question I know it's been discussed on this program before, is the government clearly has got it into its head that voters do not like the current situation, and it's quite a reasonable situation for voters not to like. There is nothing good about the spectacle of large numbers of people undertaking this difficult crossing in rickety craft and enriching criminals in the process. But is what people object to, and this is possibly the more optimistic assessment, not so much the migrants themselves, i.e. the people, but the perception that there is no process, that there is just chaos? Because while all this has been going on, I think, if I recall the number correctly, over the last year and a bit, roughly 133,000 people have moved to the United Kingdom from Hong Kong, and nobody cares. It's not remotely a political issue at all. whatsoever in the slightest.
I think this has everything to do with how the Tory party have weaponized this issue. I think they look at an election next year, they see their ratings in the polls, and they think that creating a false crisis around migration is their surest way of winning next year. I mean, even in that clip that you showed from...
I mean, it is a bit of a crisis, though.
Well, I don't think it is a crisis. If you listen to Jenrick's comment there, he very cynically talks about millions of people wanting to come. That the UK last year had 48,000 people arrive as refugees or asylum seekers. Now, just to put that in context, 50,000 refugees have gone across the Rwandan border in the last 2 months alone, and Rwanda has found a way to deal with those individuals. So this notion that a state of the size of the UK can't accommodate fewer than 50,000 refugees, he also uses this really pernicious language around illegal migrants. These people are not illegal. There is nothing illegal about these people. What you need is a functional government with a Home Office that works. You can deal with this. It's not a crisis.
But also, would you agree that upstream there is a failure because of the merging of the Foreign Office and the Overseas Development Office means that the lack of investment and resource upstream of all of this in those foreign countries where people might be given a little bit more help and information about the state of, well, I wouldn't call it good, but it's all relative in the UK. So it's a failure right along the line.
I think there's an upstream issue here, it's the UK's involvement in foreign conflicts in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and by proxy in Yemen, where they are producing this refugee crisis, so-called crisis in the first place. So you've got this perversity of the UK engaging violently in places that creates this refugee flow, and then talking about these people as a crisis that they can't possibly manage. I think this is really desperate politics by the Tories. And Andrew, as you said at the top, we've seen this in Australia, and here we are again.
Just a final thought on that. Is there something to be said, though, for the UK taking a perhaps slightly firmer line on some nationalities arriving by boat? Because the largest group arriving by boat are, in fact, Albanian, where the United Kingdom has not been involved in any conflict, at least reasonably recently. And the last time it was in conflict in that part of the world, it was actually broadly on the Albanian side. But Albania is obviously a poorer country than the United Kingdom, but it is not a dangerous country. Pete, you can live a perfectly agreeable and safe life there.
Yeah, indeed. And we used to have a really systematic process for dealing with Albanians coming here until Brexit happened. And then suddenly European cooperation, which had a process that was humane, where before people took these very dangerous journeys across the channel, you could assess their situation, you could look at their bona fides. It should also be said the vast majority of Albanians coming to the UK also have their asylum claims upheld.
True.
Often because of political repression and other forms of deprivation at home. So we used to have a decent system. Brexit has massively disrupted that.
The gift that keeps giving. Well, let's move along and consider Russian President Vladimir Putin, specifically the dwindling travel options thereof. In August, South Africa is hosting a summit of the Mid-Table Economic Powers, acronymed as BRICS. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. While Putin is yet to RSVP one way or the other, South Africa's opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, is amusing itself by pointing out that South Africa is a signatory of the Rome Statute that commits countries to the International Criminal Court, that Putin is now wanted by the ICC over war crimes, and that therefore, should Putin set foot on South African soil, South Africa's finest should be instructed to nick him. Caroline, it strikes me at least that the practicalities of this could be somewhat challenging.
Well, yes. And they're hoping that will prove to be the bit of wood in the water that prevents anybody having to make, we go back to the ethical decisions about this, because he may be, I mean, there is some precedent setting for this, the wriggle room. We saw the visit of was it somebody, remind me who it was, who came before, and they managed to, they gave him immunity.
As
head of state. And so he was just kind of given a temporary window, a tiny little window of immunity, which meant it was all fine. It's NIMBY stuff, isn't it? It's please can somebody else deal with this? It does remind me, though, of the sort of those axes. I mean, I hate to say it, but before World War II, this is a shifting of power, isn't it? I mean, normally, 15, 20 years ago, we wouldn't have bothered about these countries, whatever they thought, because they would have fallen coming into line with those great global policemen, the Americans, the Brits, perhaps the French, but certainly those big, powerful, chest-beating global powers. And now we're seeing that countries like, well, obviously Russia, but as well India and China, it's very important how they choose a side going forward. I mean, everybody is watching very carefully. I don't know if you saw last night, we had a programme on in the UK where Bear Grylls went to visit President Zelensky. The reason that programme was made is because Bear Grylls' programmes get shown in China. That's the only reason. Maybe he's a fan of Bear Grylls anyway, but it's about how it's playing. And so going forward, again, just as for the immigration solution, I'm glad that I'm not having to make that decision. But practically speaking, I don't even know how they would begin to do it. I mean, Putin just seems to, he goes into Ukraine without license and goes back again, doesn't he?
Well, indeed so. But does Putin, Phil, now have to assume that basically he can't go anywhere? Has he joined that unhappy fraternity of global figures who do at least have to speak to lawyers before they get on an aeroplane?
I think it gives him pause for thought, but I think he's confident he can continue to travel to lots of countries that are allied to Russia in this conflict. And South Africa is a test case yet again. Mm. It was a test case in 2015 with Bashir. Mm. It's the test case with Putin about if you issue an ICC arrest warrant, does it in fact deter these very powerful actors from moving? My instinct would have been up until about a week ago that South Africa would not tolerate Putin coming. I think there was a real sense from Ramaphosa's government in Pretoria that this was what Zuma did in 2015. Mm. And Ramaphosa's always tried to frame himself as more aligned with the rule of law, more respectful towards the ICC. But listening to the voices coming out of Pretoria in the last couple of days, including a comment today from the South African Minister for International Relations, she lambasted the ICC as an institution that wasn't even handed, that it goes after the West's enemies, but it won't go after the likes
of... This is a not uncommon perception in Africa generally, though,
indeed,
isn't it?
But it's been quite unusual coming out of this South African government. And it suggested to me that there are perhaps some very important voices in that government that are quite favourable towards Putin. And then, of course, the backdrop to all of this is the fact that South Africa has not supported the UN General Assembly's resolution to try to sanction Russia over the war in Ukraine. That this is something that the US has been very angry with South Africa about, that they haven't come out and supported that. And it's because South Africa see Russia as a really important ally. So when they're calculating whether Putin should come to the BRICS summit in August, keeping Russia on side as a very powerful political, military and diplomatic ally is undoubtedly part of that calculation.
More weirdly, Caroline, there's at least one country which is not only a European country but a member of the actual EU and the even more actual NATO. This is Hungary, which has gone out of its way to say that should President Putin drop in, they would not arrest him. I mean, again, you have to say it would be kind of amusing to watch them try, but surely Hungary, you would think, given what it's allied with, shouldn't have trouble to picking a side here.
I know. And what's so worrying about that is that it's geographical position. I mean, you would think that sort of just organically it would somehow fall into line with those Western powers. But clearly not. It's becoming a real life horrifying game of risk, isn't it? And what I worry about is that the more states ignore these instruments of power and deterrence and arrests, the weaker they become. I mean, they're only as influential and significant as people recognise them to be. So as countries fall like dominoes saying, well, we'll just ignore it, it will be like the Gulf War, won't it? Back in the early 2000s when the UN said one thing and America just said something else.
I mean, Phil, it was much remarked upon at the time that the issuing of a warrant for the arrest of Vladimir Putin would have a largely symbolic value and that the chances of him ever ending up in the dock in The Hague, I mean, it's not unimaginable, but you wouldn't bet a lot of money on it. Does the symbolic value become lessened if it just becomes increasingly clear that it's never going to happen? Does the ICC risk making itself look weak?
I think so, and even a couple of years ago, I think the last time I published a blockbuster, it was on the International Criminal Court in Africa. We talked about exactly this fact that on several occasions, the ICC had gone after sitting heads of state. It had gone after Bashir in Sudan. It had gone after Kenyatta and Ruto in Kenya. And every time it has tried to do that, it has failed. We've never seen those individuals get anywhere near the dock because the court itself is very weak. It's completely...
What was the last big victory for the ICC?
It hasn't had many, to be honest. You know, it's had...
The Balkans? maybe?
That was a special tribunal for Yugoslavia. Ad hoc tribunal. So if you look at the court's record, it's only been able to successfully prosecute rebel leaders, non-state actors. It has no track record whatsoever on prosecuting sitting members of government because it's so dependent on states to arrest them. Mm-hmm. It has no police force of its own. So it's beholden to the likes of South Africa to do what the ICC wants, which is to actually capture Putin, put him on a plane and get him to The Hague. And I think that looks very unlikely.
Well, let's move along to altogether less transcendent concerns. And for many European cities which have acquired or cultivated a somewhat salacious reputation, the lockdowns occasioned by COVID-19 had one considerable upside: the enforced absence of marauding gangs of young British men celebrating the imminent, if frankly inexplicable, wedding of one of their number by wearing stupid costumes, acting like idiots and falling into canals and making a tremendous amount of noise and mess while so doing. One destination thus plagued, Amsterdam, has now launched a targeted online ad campaign enjoining this pestilential demographic to go elsewhere. Caroline, as there is absolutely no record available of young Australians behaving in such a reprehensible manner, we are going to have to ask you to answer for your people on this one. Seriously, what is it about young British men travelling en masse? Why are they like they are?
I asked the same question because it really isn't restricted to Amsterdam. I mean, for years, I would say while I was growing up, I mean, I'm not going to blame my own generation, but before I hit the pub, it was very much, please come over, you Brits, and spend your hard-earned cash in our cities. And we kept going further and further east. You know, it was Germany and France, Paris and the German cities for years. And then suddenly we started hearing about Prague. Amsterdam is a perennial. Mm. But clearly, it has tipped over, and the need for that British cash has been trumped by a quite understandable distaste for everything that comes with it. And I just don't think a fine of €140 is anything like enough. I mean, people, these young lads, of whom I hear tell, they probably budget for that, wouldn't they? I mean, that's a round of dreams.
It does bring me round, Phil, to my principal concern with this ad, which is that the demographic at which it is targeted is rather likely to look at this and go, this looks amazing.
Game on. It also assumes any of them can read. Yeah. And I think that the jury may be out on that. But I do love the specificity of this ad campaign, that it's British men aged between 18 and 35. So it's not all men aged between 18 and 35. It's not anyone over the age of 35, because you and I, Andrew, clearly wouldn't do any of this sort of stuff in Amsterdam. So I do admire the targeting of a very particular audience here.
I have one thought, which is, I know, I mean, we jest, but there is a problem with alcohol in this country that doesn't exist on the continent in the same way. And I do think it comes down to those very elegant dinner parties, Mediterranean lunches that we see, where the tots are encouraged to sort of have a sip of wine, perhaps in an egg cup. It's very much in the family tradition. And so,
you're advocating giving more alcohol to children?
Younger. Yes.
Okay, well, it's a take. It is an extraordinary thing to watch. And Caroline, you're right. It has gone further and further east. And it is weird the effect it has on the economies of often quite small towns. I was in Bratislava last June, where once you figure out how the old city of Bratislava works, you start to understand there's two entirely parallel old cities of Bratislava in a very small space. There are those venues which obviously cater to the stag do's, which are plentiful, and there are those venues which very much do not. And they don't actually put up signs in the window saying, large numbers of young pissed British men, please keep out. But they do this. I don't even know whether they're doing it consciously, but you will go past, you'll go past the stag party variety bars, and then you'll go past a bar which just has bookshelves with leather volumes on them, lots of big leather armchairs, serves agreeable wine and posh cheeses, and obviously you go in there and there are no stag do's.
It will have changed by now, Andrew.
I hope
that leather chair will have a Union Jack flag attached to it and a pair of young man's knickers.
But Phil, is there a way that any city like Amsterdam or indeed Bratislava or any of the others can have it both ways, because obviously they do want the money. They do want tourism. They just want to not have to clean up after it.
Yeah, that was my immediate reaction reading this story, was that Amsterdam has marketed itself precisely to this demographic for precisely those purposes for 40 or 50 years. I think the stag do genie is out of the bottle on that one. I don't think they can have it both ways.
Have either of you, I will start with you, Caroline, ever actually participated in such an expedition? Have you ever put on a funny hat, worn a custom-made T-shirt advertising the stag and or hen weekend of whoever it was and gone off marauding?
Oh, I think there was a little trip to Lisbon,
now it all
not
comes
necessarily
out.
Amsterdam, where we all ended up wearing fake moustaches. But that really was the extent of the debauchery, I'm pleased to say.
No one ended up in prison?
No.
No.
I mean, see, this is it. See, this. I there is a part of me that must resist my what would you call it? My grooming as a Brit, that I have to say no, fail. Right? What a bunch of losers we are. We didn't try hard enough. But then I bow to the Aussies when it comes to the effort in that direction.
Well, and Phil, have you ever partaken of such an outing? Have you ever had to be fished out of a canal by the local gendarmes?
It's been pretty close to that, and I think even my own stag do in Grahamstown in South Africa probably would have fallen foul of the Amsterdam authorities. It did end up with about 20 of my friends at about 4 o'clock in the morning stumbling out of the only club in town and going home on donkey carts, taken back by a fairly worried donkey cart owner. So, I read this story with a certain amount of shame and trepidation.
But just before we move off it, Phil, I will give you the chance as the designated Australian guest at the desk to if you want to generalise about the British and is this what is now left of that same animating instinct that set them off to conquer the world, because the British just turning up places and acting obnoxiously did at one point build an empire on which the sun never set.
Very positive.
I wanted to say that these groups do things abroad that they wouldn't really do at home, except if you see this demographic, this is exactly what they do at home. It's just more fun to do it in exotic climes.
I've been in Berwick-upon-Tweed at closing time on a Friday.
But what I did notice in Australia was that they're all the same as the Brits, except there's always one with a broken leg and crutches, but it doesn't stop him.
He's emulated. That's Steve-O.
Yeah. Steve-O, that guy. But anyway, huge news also for any listener seeking a career change coupled with the opportunity to end up being a stooge in a cutesy viral video. In China's Jiangsu province, the Nanshan Mountain Bamboo Scenery Zone is struggling to fill the vacant post of panda keeper. While they have received many applications, none have met the apparently exacting threshold. Qualifications are degree in veterinary medicine or livestock rearing. Duties include correctly scattering bamboo and weighing panda feces. I'm just reading this out. No time wasters. Caroline, first of all, have your recent travails perhaps prompted any kind of midlife crisis,
which
has occasioned rethinking, what am I doing with my life? Should I jack in the writing about books about carry-on films, which are still available in all good stores, and retrain as a panda keeper?
Well, a good friend of mine tells me that pandas are the benefit scroungers of the natural system because they do very little. But of course, it really doesn't matter because they have stripes. And as far as I'm concerned, where do I apply? I mean, how are they having trouble filling this role?
I think I know how they're having trouble filling this role. And that's why I mentioned the viral videos. And I do commend our listeners to them. I don't know how you would find them on YouTube. I think maybe if you just search Grumpy Panda Keeper. There is a recurring one of a young Chinese woman who is a panda keeper, and the films are of her at work, and whatever appeal the job may once have held for her has clearly... she's over it. She's trying to do panda keeping stuff, and these useless, clumsy, stupid roly-poly animals just keep pushing a basket over or hanging onto a leg or just generally getting in the way, and it's gone.
I also think, and your statement there that sort of inverted the order in which the particular official listed the duties, it might be advisable not to start with weighing their feces. It would be a little bit like an academic job where you remind the person that you will have to mark 4,000 undergraduate essays in the midst of the summer. You might want to bury that as the kind of tenth of the responsibilities.
What would you have as the number one then, the entry responsibility? Just stroking the stripes, brushing the stripes.
Doesn't there have to be some narrative about the kind of holiness, the sacred nature of the panda that you're, you know, embedding yourself in, you know, some grand historical narrative? This is your duty to the Chinese nation, or you should be writing their ad copy.
Yeah,
I'm making a pitch here. Yeah, I don't want the job of the panda, but I can help them get one.
But have either of you ever at any point countenanced jacking it all in and doing something involving working with animals, nature, trees, etc.?
If you count pulling pints in a West Irish seaside tavern, that's working with nature, I think, isn't it? I think we've touched on this before. This is my other pathway. This is the path not taken. Is that, I'm not sure it's natural enough, but there are so, I mean, as you can imagine, I was whacked over the head with wellness recommendations from various friends. And all I really wanted to do was just sit and watch box set after box set during my hiatus. But I hear that embracing nature at least once a day is increasingly crucial in this digital age. So and then add a pack. Panda, come on. Again, how are they having trouble filling the role?
Phil, do you have a path not taken, and was it in fact weighing panda feces?
Yeah, I during lockdown in a small flat with three small children doing online teaching, I would gladly have done this job. So I felt like it came at the wrong time.
Or indeed any other job.
Yeah, anything that involved not being in that particular cramped space. So this would have been delightful about 2 years ago.
Even the weighing?
Anything. I was doing the same thing at home. I mean, I was weighing feces by the tons. It's, you know, my kids are not nearly as lovable as the Chinese pandas.
Well, on that upmarket note, Phil Clark and Caroline Frost, thank you both for joining us. And finally, on today's show, our On This Day historical feature recalls the arguably inadvertent beginning of one of the biggest and most resonant of Britain's imperial upheavals. In any conflict, someone has to fire the first shot. In most conflicts, this will be some relatively lowly soldier acting on the orders of superior officers who are themselves conveying the instructions of their political masters. Sometimes we know who fired the first shot, sometimes we don't. And just sometimes, someone acts on their own initiative and unleashes an upheaval which many of its participants, certainly many of its victims, didn't expect or didn't want. One such was Mangal Pandey, a soldier of the 34th Bengal Native Infantry, stationed at Barrackpore in West Bengal, who on March 29th, 1857, set in train the carnage remembered by history as the Indian Mutiny. It remains uncertain how clearly Pandey was thinking on this day 166 years ago. It has been speculated ever since that he was under the influence of cannabis and or opium when he did what he did. It is possible that this was the case, but no less likely that his motivations have been besmirched by those who came to ardently wish he hadn't done it. It is known what Pandey was angry about. Pandey was a sepoy, an Indian soldier serving the East India Company, the British corporation which by 1857 had controlled India for a century, give or take, and which had more men under arms than Britain's actual army. Pandey and his fellow sepoys were to be issued with a new rifle, the P-53 Enfield. As part of the drill of loading the Enfield, a soldier was obliged to bite the end off the powder cartridge. A rumour had got about that the cartridges were greased with either pork lard or beef tallow, the former obviously unacceptable to Muslim soldiers, the latter forbidden to Hindus like Pandey. A codicil to this scuttlebutt suggested that the British had laced the grease deliberately to insult and undermine the faiths of company soldiers. The much more plausible explanation of mishap and miscommunication went unconsidered, as it often does. Pandey attempted to lead his comrades in revolt. It was, in the short term, a failure. Few were much interested in following him. Pandey injured only two British soldiers before shooting himself non-fatally and was hanged for his impertinence 10 days later. In the long term, Pandey struck the East India Company a rather more withering blow. The first proper insurrection of the mutiny took place on May 10th, when the 3rd Bengal Light Cavalry at Meerut refused the new Enfield cartridges. Sepoys were at least as outraged by the subsequent punishment and humiliation of the soldiers involved. The following day, the mutineers took Delhi. All such rebels would become known with a mix of derision and fear as Pandeys. No simple narrative summarises the next ghastly couple of years. While Indians certainly fought against the British, Indians also fought for the British and amongst themselves. Hideous atrocities were committed by all participants as key locations imprinted themselves into the imperial lexicon of valour and/or vainglory: Gwalior, Jhansi, Cawnpore, Lucknow. By 1858, Britain's government called time on the experiment in outsourcing the ruling of India and assumed all the East India Company's powers. The company was wound up in 1874. It has since suited India to recall Mangal Pandey as a martyr in the cause of independence. This probably isn't entirely wrong, but it's almost certainly not entirely right. Nevertheless, he has appeared on an Indian postage stamp and been portrayed on the big screen by Amir Khan, no less.
Kya ho gaya tum logo? Dikhai nahi deta. Jis pal ka hame intezar tha, wo pal aa gaya hai. Waqt aa gaya hai apna wachan nibhane ka.
India's current Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has had himself photographed bowing before the statue of Pandey that stands now in Meerut, and on Pandey's birthday in 2022, all but attempted to adopt him.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi honoured Mangal Pandey, who fired the first shot of the 1857 Independence War. Remembering him on his birth anniversary, had paid tributes to his statue in Meerut earlier this year. Modi tweeted, sharing a picture of him paying tributes to the freedom fighter.
The reality was all rather more complicated than that. As was noted in the British Parliament a few months after Pandey's lonely insurrection by Benjamin Disraeli, then an opposition MP, later Prime Minister.
The decline and fall of empires are not affairs of greased cartridges. Such results are occasioned by adequate causes and by an accumulation of adequate causes.
At the time, as so often during Britain's empire building, insufficient interest was taken in what those adequate causes of discontent might have been or how to address them short of calamity. In the same speech, Disraeli also demonstrated his acute understanding of the degree to which history is just one damn thing after another.
It is remarkable how insignificant incidents at the first blush have appeared, which have proved to be pregnant with momentous consequences.
For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Caroline Frost and Phil Clark. The show was produced by Lillian Fawcett and researched by Andre Nikolai Pamantuan. Our sound engineer was Adam Heaton. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.